It is good to be back, guys. Yes, it is so, my voice.
Yes, our special guest this week is none other than Tessa.
And you know, I know. Is it so? It is so. It is.
And we're coming to you. And we hopped right back into old habits and we're coming at you almost live again.
Almost live again. Of all episodes to be cursed, of course, October is just like, woo, like, oh man, I was like, I'm ready every time and I am not every time. So
it happens.
Sorry.
I don't even care. It's fine. I'm just happy to have you back.
You know, in the first episode of the season, you were like, I think I forgot how to do a podcast. Like, let me tell you how much I forgot how to do a podcast. My computer forgot how to do a podcast.
Yeah, so. It really did. It forgot how to even like register that you had a microphone plugged in.
And it's been plugged in the whole dang time, guys. I just figured it would be like riding a bike, but here we are flopping all over the place with our training wheels just, you know, east.
Maybe we should just never take the training wheels off.
Never, ever, ever. Just leave them on. Just for decoration and support.
And stability, yeah.
So anyway, hi guys. It is lovely to be back podcasting with you guys back in your warm ear holes. It's entertaining in here. You guys, hey, maybe lay off on the Q-tips though. So hi, how's it going? It's Conspiracies and Cryptids. We talk about conspiracies and cryptids, not ear holes.
We just mention ear holes a lot.
Exactly. Because they're important.
They are important. But yeah, so, you know, it's October 15th. This month is surprisingly already half over. I don't know how.
Oh my gosh. You have done a wonderful job keeping the ship afloat while I have been away and with our wonderful, wonderful guests. They are just so awesome.
They've been so much fun. Each and every one of our guests, if you're listening, thank you all so much, you know, and yes, for the guests we've got coming, thank you all. It's,
oh my gosh,
it's
so
been
exciting.
Such a pleasure working with all of you and getting to know all of you. And I hope that all of our listeners have enjoyed it as well, you know, and that it's opened them up to some new podcasts to listen to. So it's been a lot of fun, you know, like expanding our little podcast family.
Good. I'm so glad. I'm just so tickled. I would love to burn books with Dustin sometime. That would just, oh, that sounds like such a treat.
Oh, it's a lot of, Dustin's a lot of fun to review books with. He was a blast. So,
oh, awesome,
and I'm
awesome.
Sure he would love to have you on sometime if you ever had time for that.
I'm up for it. If I can find a working computer. Oh man. Oh, hey, Halloween's coming up.
Halloween is coming up. And if you haven't seen on our Facebook and our Twitter, and I need to make a post for Instagram as well. We're doing a special Halloween episode. We do a Halloween episode every year. But this year we're doing something a little bit different than we've done in previous years. Last year we talked about like a true crime story. And I think the year before that we talked about like some Halloween style cryptids. But this year we're going to do something else different. We are taking submissions from you, our listeners, of your ghost stories and personal experiences with the paranormal. So email us your personal ghost stories and creepy experiences to conspiriesandcryptids@gmail.com, or you can send them to us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, you know, whichever is easiest for you. Just send us an email with your story, and you know, we're going to do our best to read as many of them as we can for our Halloween episode. And we're not reading them really in advance. We might have Ian screen them for us.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, make sure we don't get, you know, like, you know, raked over the coals. I said raked. I'm going to go back there. Just, you know, we don't get, you know, just embarrassed. You know, don't embarrass us. No,
yes.
It's not.
Also, but, you know, if and when you do email us, please feel free to let us know your preferred pronouns. Yep. So that, you know, we do our best to to be respectful to everybody. If you feel your name is difficult to pronounce, we would appreciate a pronunciation guide for your name so that we pronounce it right.
I would love to respect to pay you the respect, you know, absolutely. But, absolutely.
But we really hope to hear from you. We've gotten one email so far since I posted that Facebook post.
I know you guys have spooky stories.
We know
I have
you guys have
stories.
Spooky stories. You guys tell us all the time that you have spooky stories. So please let us know. We would love to read them out loud and, you know,
please
partake in the spookiness. So
I have one I want to share. So
yes, you definitely need to
excited.
Share it.
So,
and you know, my dad told me one that I'm going to share on the air. So we do have our own personal ones we're going to share with you all as well, but we're a community here at Conspiracies and Cryptids, and you listeners are part of this cryptid community. So
virtual hugs.
All around. From Mothman.
Oh, yeah. that's quite a wingspan. There's plenty of hugs for everybody.
Did you see one of our friends in the crypt posted like this new Mothman-looking sighting?
Yes.
Super creepy. So, yeah, those are sort of things that go on in the crypt, which is open to our $5 a month patrons and up. It is a Facebook group that is, you know, like a bunch of us listeners and me and Tessa as well, where you can interact with us. We share memes, we share articles.
Conspiracies and cryptids related.
We get off topic. We talk about just anything that piques our interest.
Exactly.
So it's a place where you can get to know us and get to know your fellow conspirators. So that's something to look into.
So you know what else I want to get to know? Let's get to know some conspiracies and cryptids,
yes.
Shall we?
We shall.
For the return of the season for the first time.
Oh, the official penny for our thoughts.
The official penny for our thoughts. It rises from the bartendery watery grave.
From the underground shot glass. Speaking of that, did you hear last week's episode?
Oh, yes.
Because it was about mud floods and about how like Sacramento's underground was actually covered up by mud floods that have been covered up in history.
When our
guest Levi talked about that, I was like, Tess and I went on one of those tours.
So
it tied things in and we never even knew there was a conspiracy about it.
Oh my gosh. So cool. So cool. So we are very happy to return. So,
yes.
So who gets to pick now?
You pick.
I think you should pick. You've held the show down.
Okay.
You should pick.
I will pick, but I'm hoping you get to go first.
Okay. I'm kind of hoping too. This is a good one, guys.
All right. I will pick heads.
It's heads.
Gosh. My dad has said I need to take this luck that I have because I win it like every time.
Every day time, Sammy.
My dad says I need
guest.
To take this luck down to the casinos downtown in like downtown Biloxi.
Go play the slots.
Okay. All right. I will go first. I will begrudgingly go first.
And then you guys have to wait for me. That's even better.
That is. We'll save the best for last. So
get to react to Sammy. How nice.
So last episode with Levi, I told him that I needed to stop putting off generic sea and lake monsters so that we don't end up having an entire season of knockoff Nessies.
That's a very good point.
So that is what I'm doing today. I am doing a knockoff Nessie, and I'm talking about a lake monster that hails from the state of Georgia and is known as Altamahaha.
Altamahaha.
Yes, Altamahaha.
Okay. So, I love it. Please educate me about Altamahaha.
Altamahaha is 20 to 30 feet long or 6 to 9 meters long. It has a sturgeon-like body with a long ridge along its back. It only has front flippers, no rear appendages. So it's not like a Nessie where, you know, it's seen to have four flippers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is
okay,
just
in the front.
Yes, it's almost like a manatee, you know, where it has front flippers and a tail.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is like.
Okay.
It has a crocodile-like snout. It swims like a dolphin, so it does that kind of undulating swimming.
Oh, weird.
Ooh. It has large protruding eyes, sharp teeth, grayish-green skin with a yellowish underbelly.
Weird.
They've actually, like, I've got an image that comes from Wikipedia, and they've made it really cute, and I will share this. But it's like, they actually made it kind of adorable.
I mean, I'll be honest, I don't think I'd be afraid of an Altamahaha either. Yeah, it looks like kind of a plesiosaur.
Kind of, yeah. but just without the back flippers.
Exactly.
Because like, no. This is a plesiosaur. Hang on. I have to stop sharing.
Yeah, there. Did you guys see that the comparison recently that the plesiosaur is basically a penguin?
I did not see that.
It's, oh my gosh, guys, look it up. It's like, oh my gosh, yeah, you're right. They just like a penguin, like a plesiosaur just like stood up and walked around on land and it became a penguin. It just got real short. You see,
this is a plesiosaur.
Hey, look,
I have a little toy Loch Ness monster in my studio that I've had since literally I was a kid. So.
How cute. But,
yes.
That plesiosaurs me.
Plesiosaurs me. Oh, that was bad. I love it.
Terrible. You guys are just so happy to have me back.
So before colonists ever settled the region, there were sightings that dated back to the Native Americans, as there usually were. It's just the first sightings that were ever officially documented were when white settlers came in, because they were a little bit more meticulous about documenting like written down history. So, but there were native tales and stories told about a large water dwelling serpent. And this was from the Native American tribe, the Tama, from that region. And they told of a serpent that was 20 to 30 feet long, that lived in the rivers and streams that made up the Altamaha. And then the Creek Indian tribes that also lived in that area had stories of many large serpents that lived in the lakes and rivers of that region of Georgia. So both the Indian tribes that were native to that region,
like, oh yeah, there's stuff in there.
Had tales of sea serpents. Huh. The first documented sightings from settlers and colonizers were from the 1500s, specifically from Jacques Lemoyne, who was the first European artist in North America. And he was illustrating the New World and making maps. He was a cartographer, basically. And he did a lot of those illustrated maps. And somewhere off the Georgia and Florida coast in the mid-1500s, he had tons of these monsters show up, you know. And I've got a picture I can show you of one of them that he drew. But there was a quote that said, Lemoyne wasn't here to draw maps filled with imaginary monsters or warnings like here be dragons. Because a lot of old maps for undocumented and uncharted territory, they put a warning, here be dragons, not because there were actually dragons there, but that was kind of a warning that this is the unknown. You know, so they would.
Interesting.
Yeah. So they would put that. Yeah. So they would put that on maps as like a warning that, hey, we don't know what's over here. We just know that there's land here that's been unexplored.
Just probably dragons. Yes. I don't know. Maybe dragons.
Yeah. So they would put that wording there, and then they would also draw dragons on the map. But that was just kind of to let people be aware of the fact that this is undiscovered territory. Cool. But Lemoyne was making maps of discovered territory and was still drawing monsters on it. So it's not thought that he was doing it to warn people, but actually showing maybe some of the wildlife that was there, because his job was not just to draw the maps, but was also to catalog the flora and fauna of the region.
Science.
He was there to make maps and also keep a record of what plants and animals could be found. Neat. In each area that he illustrated.
So he's there to find all the, he's there to explore and explain the unexplained.
Yes. Yep. So, and that quote came from Taylor Brown, who was a novelist who grew up at the mouth of the Altamaha on Little St. Simon's Island. Hmm. So, they went on to say, his alligators are misshapen and dinosaur-like, more like descriptions of the Altamaha than any alligator I've seen, Brown says. The head is too big, the neck too long, and the effect is something that looks a lot like a small version of the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh,
so, and
weird.
I will show you an image of this as well, and I will put all of these up on our Instagram because I'm trying to be better about that. But you can see this alligator has a long neck, and it's,
look at that.
It's like the size of 6 full grown men.
It just looks like a fat alligator, like just got a little bit more chunk neck.
Yeah. But like I said, the neck's longer and the face is different.
Yeah.
They don't look like traditional alligators.
You're
the size of them is massive. You know, like most alligators,
compared to man, yeah.
Yeah, like most alligators will get up to like maybe 12 or 13 feet long, with some getting up to 16 or 17 feet. But that's bigger than 16 or 17 feet if you look at the proportions.
Definitely don't need a banana for scale for that one.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Wow.
Yeah. The next sighting that I have wasn't until April 18th of 1830. So it was, 300 years later.
Wow.
A correspondent of the Savannah, Georgian newspaper reported multiple sightings of a sea monster on the Georgia coast. The primary eyewitness was Captain Delano of the schooner Eagle, who reported seeing a large creature off of St. Simon's Island below the mouth of the Altamaha River. His description stated that it was about 70 feet long, its circumference about the size of a barrel, and its head resembled that of an alligator. And 70 feet long, that's way too big to be an alligator.
Way too big.
So,
wow. That's like
five
a couple
other
alligators.
Yeah.
It's an alligator train. Can you imagine an alligator train coming at you?
Oh, God. I mean, yes, I can imagine that because I was just at an alligator farm 2 days ago with my parents.
Oh,
so,
well, what reference? Wow.
So if you ever come visit, I can take you on a gator farm tour where they take you out on one of those airboats and take you around the swamp.
That sounds like fun.
It actually was a lot of fun. So
that's very cool.
But yeah, so I can imagine what a gator train would look like because they had a bunch of them just swimming around there. Hmm. So yeah. Five other men on the boat also reported having seen the monster, as well as several planters on the island itself. A quote from the Savannah, Georgian newspaper said he repeated the particulars precisely, describing the animal he saw as being about 70 feet long, circumference about that of a sugar hogshead, moving with its head shaped like an alligator's about 8 feet out of the water. So the head of the of this creature was 8 feet out of the water.
Jeez, that's like
a long
quite
neck.
That's quite a long neck. Yes, yeah. That is very Nessie-ish.
It is, yeah. Hmm. It's a knockoff Nessie.
Yeah.
The next sighting was about 100 years later in the 1920s. And I've got a lot of these like really short sightings where it's like they didn't have any more information than just like a sentence. So I'm going to rattle a couple of these off kind of quickly. So in the 1920s, some loggers and timbermen riding the river, because they used to use the river to transport timber. You know, back before we had flatbed trailers and trucks, they would float the timber down the river.
And then the last guy would just kind of tootle along in the last log at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And
So as these timbermen were riding the river, they reported sighting large snake-like water monsters.
Hmm.
In 1935, so 15 years later, a group of hunters spotted what they called a giant snake swimming through the river.
Ooh.
5 years later, in the 1940s, a group of Boy Scouts reported seeing the creature. Mm. In the 1950s, two officials from the Reidsville State Prison reported seeing it.
Wow.
Because the prison was like on the river.
Oh.
In 1969, two brothers were fishing on the Altamaha River at Clark's Bluff. They reported seeing an animal that they first thought was a sturgeon because, once again, the ridge is on the back.
Mm-hmm.
But quickly changed their mind when they got a better look, stating that it measured 10 to 12 feet long with a snout like an alligator and a horizontal tail. So, because sturgeons have, vertical tail,
vertical
like a shark
tail,
or something like that.
So
but horizontal, like a dolphin tail or a mammal
like
tail.
Like a manatee. Huh.
Yeah. Maybe it is a freshwater manatee. But
it might be. It's just, on Weight Watchers.
Yeah.
It's
and a with a skinny. Long neck.
Yeah.
But they also described the creature as having a triangular ridge along the top of its body, sharp pointed teeth, and being gunmetal gray in color.
Oh, ooh.
So the tail and the color says manatee.
Yeah.
The ridge and pointed teeth do not.
They do not. No, that's one vicious manatee.
Yeah. In the 1970s, Harvey Blackman of Brunswick said he had seen the creature in the 70s. He said it had a snake-like head and was 15 to 20 feet long, and that he had seen it at a point called Two Way on the Altamaha River. Another eyewitness, Frank Culpepper, saw its wake in the same area. He said it left behind a billow of water so big that it caused boats to bump around.
Ooh.
Right? One of the men with him ran for a rifle because, as with all cryptids, you got to get your trigger-happy Americans in there.
Got to shoot it, apparently.
Got to shoot it.
I mean, I'm not advocating for the shooting of it, but that's always the story.
That's always the story. Every cryptid has somebody shooting at it. Always does.
We're doomed.
But it was gone before he could get a shot, so.
Of course. Good, good, good.
In the summer of 1980, Andy Green and Barry Prescott reportedly saw Altamahaha stranded on a mud bank near Cathead Creek. They reported that the animal was lying halfway in the water, thrashing and trying to free itself from the bank. They described it as being dark-colored with rough skin and about 20 feet long. While watching, the creature freed itself, submerged, and disappeared. So they didn't see it half-submerged in the water. They saw it up on land.
Whoa.
Kind of beached.
Ooh, getting some sun.
Mm. Yeah. And
tanning its belly.
There were a couple of sightings throughout history of people that saw it partially on land. You know, so it's like, if it's on land, it's a little bit harder to mistake it for something else.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because you've clearly seen it, you know, at that point.
Like, that's a, yeah, exactly, when you've kind of seen
the whole
iceberg.
That's not a sturgeon, you know.
Yeah.
In December of 1980, another man reported having seen what he thought was Altamahaha in Smith Lake. His description said the animal was 15 to 20 feet long, snake-like, with two brown humps that protruded from the water and left behind a wake like that of a speedboat.
Oh.
So you notice all of these sightings, though, are about the same size.
Yeah, same size, same length that they estimate, you know, which is so funny because it's like, how can you really tell? It's underwater.
Yeah, yeah. And then another report in the 1980s was described by a crab fisherman, stated the creature looked like the world's biggest eel.
Hmm.
In 1981, former newspaper publisher Larry Gwynn reported seeing the creature while fishing with his friend Steve Wilson. They said it had two big humps about 5 feet apart and left behind a wake like that of a speedboat. So it moves pretty quickly.
Yeah.
In 2002, a man pulling a boat up the river near Brunswick, reported seeing something over 20 feet in length and 6 feet wide break the water.
Ooh.
In 2010, an amateur photographer captured video of something strange swimming in the channel off Fort King George Historic Site in Darien. And I've got that video if you want to see
it. Ooh, well, you know what that means. We got to call Ghostbusters because there's something strange.
So I'm going to pull this up and play it, and I'll play some elevator music while we're watching it. And then I'll post it on, you know, like our Facebook and stuff.
Please
like
do.
That.
Yeah. But that's, wow, that's super interesting. Wow. Wow.
Yes.
That, so, that could be anything.
Yeah. So I will post that video to our social media because it's super fascinating.
That is.
I shouldn't have stopped sharing
Screen
because I had something else to show you. So in 2018, decomposing remains were found on a beach in the Wolf Island National Wildlife Refuge by Jeff Warren and his son, causing speculation that it may be the body of Altamahaha.
Ooh.
What he at first thought was a dead seal upon closer inspection looked more like a baby sea monster or a throwback to the Jurassic.
Mm.
He's quoted saying, "This isn't a joke." He sent the photo into news outlets, including the Savannah Morning News, and he said, "There was a heron and some seagulls pulling its guts out and eating them, but they flew away when I got close." So, and I actually have a picture of that.
Ooh, poor guy. Yeah, it looks kind of like a...
It looks
like
kind
something
of sea monster-y.
Didn't quite grow, but it looks large.
Yep.
Interesting. Wow.
Yep.
Can you imagine walking up on something like that? Ooh.
I don't want to. It's kind of gross and creepy. But
no.
Explanations as to what Altamahaha could be, an alligator gar, which I don't know if you've ever seen those, but they're a very interesting looking fish.
Mm-hmm.
We actually saw some of those yesterday at the Biloxi or the Gulf Coast Aquarium here in Biloxi.
Cool.
So, you know, I've seen all of these things like very recently.
You've been doing some research, my dear.
Unintentionally,
my
but yes. So, because I wrote this script before I ever went and looked at those things, but just kind of worked out. But yeah, alligator gars are really interesting looking fish, and they can get pretty big.
You don't want to mess with those.
They can get, you know, about 10 feet long in some cases, and they've got nasty little mouthful of needle sharp teeth. They're gross looking.
Nasty.
Another explanation is that it's just a hoax. For example, that 2018 corpse that they found, performance artist Zardulu claimed responsibility later for the remains, which he said were created out of a stuffed shark corpse and paper mache.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he's claiming that he made it, and it was just like a publicity stunt.
Just a publicity stunt. You know, darn.
Kind of like a cryptid version of Banksy.
Yes.
A cryptid Banksy.
A cryptid Banksy. Artistic.
Yeah. Other explanations is that it's an alligator, maybe a shark that accidentally found its way into fresh water. Which does happen sometimes. You know, they don't last very long, but it can happen. Freshwater eels, or once again, as with all of these knockoff Nessies, a living fossil or some kind of plesiosaur, you know.
Always, that's always just a possibility. It's always a possibility. Now, we don't know everything.
We don't. Now, I do have a fun fact about this, and it's just kind of a neat little twist. The original settlers of this area were recruited in 1735 at Iverness, Scotland. So they hail from Iverness, Scotland, which is the city alongside of Loch Ness.
Oh.
So it's known for its sightings of the Loch Ness monster.
So these are creative people anyway.
Yeah. So the Highlanders even called their settlement New Iverness before changing the name to Darien, which it is now currently named.
I see.
So it seems kind of appropriate that the beast that inhabits the waters around Darien is possibly a twin, you know, from the founders of the Loch Ness area. So it's just, it's a neat little tie-in that, you know, the people from Loch Ness settled in an area that also potentially has a lake monster.
Maybe they brought a little baby with them. They were like, here's a tadpole. We're just going to release it here.
Yeah.
We had one at home. Feels like home.
Yeah. Boop. And then Altamahaha has a nickname in the local area. They call it Alti.
Alti. How cute.
Yeah, so
now I know more about Altamahaha. Yeah,
so that's Alti or Altamahaha. But, you know, like I said, there were sightings in Native American culture as well. So it did predate,
you know, even the settlers.
The Scottish settlers. It's just a kind of interesting coincidence.
How cool. Cool. So that they saw it and they were like, oh, we got one too.
Oh, we already know what those are. They weren't surprised by it.
And they're going to try to shoot it anyway.
They're going to try to, that's just, it's just what happens.
Just silly Americans. Mm-hmm. My goodness. Well, that was very educational. Thank you very much.
Of course.
And I think it's time for a break, right?
Yep.
And then we'll, right? Because I still, like I said, guys, I forgot how to do this, right? Then we do a break for like 15 seconds.
Yep.
And then when we come back, it's 15
seconds for us. It's less than that for the listeners unless they want to pause, because this is a good spot to pause.
It's
go
true.
To the bathroom, get a drink, get a cup of coffee.
Like they haven't been peeing the whole time they've been listening to
most people listen to podcasts in the car.
You finished what you were doing, whatever you were doing, like 30 minutes ago.
Probably. All right. We'll be right back.
Okay. Oh. Well, that was a nice break.
Now
we're on to a new activity, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
We've made it to the office.
Yep.
You have to go inside the office. I'm sorry. Actually, you don't, because we're still in the middle of a pandemic. Go home. What are you doing? Why did you drive there? All right. Anyway, but speaking of the pandemic, though, I do, again, want to extend a very special thank you to Dustin and Ava and Brad and Julia and our guests that are yet to come that I won't spoil for you guys yet. For filling in for me, though, while I've been away, you guys are rock stars, and I really appreciate it. And Sammy, you have been wonderful, obviously, keeping our podcast in line, keeping all of our unruly guests, you know, in podcast line.
Right.
But Halloween's coming up in a couple of weeks, and like, that's like my favorite holiday. Mm-hmm. And I'm sad to say I have no Halloween decorations up. I have one floor mat when you're walking in, and it's like, that's my, I get excited to change the entryway mat because I have them for different seasons.
Right.
And I'm like, yay, this is my Halloween decoration this year, because I just, like, I'm just not in the spirit. Aww. Like, it's hard this year, but so please send me like lots of things to get me in the spirit for Halloween. I'm just need the mood, need the spooky mood.
Have you seen my decorations?
I have your alien decorations. You're so awesome. You're
Did
so
you
creative.
See the, I don't think the UFO is, no, the UFO was not done the last time I recorded with Levi. So I made a UFO, you guys, out of a porch umbrella that I covered in tinfoil.
That's so great.
It took 3.5 rolls of tinfoil.
Oh my God.
And like a roll and a half of like
tin
clear
foil
packing
so,
tape.
Well, at least it's expensive here.
I got it at Dollar General.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
Yeah. So it was like 3.5 rolls of tin foil, a roll and a half of like clear packing tape, and some duct tape as well. And then I also taped on 2 strands of green string lights so that it looks like a crashed UFO in my front yard.
It is fabulous. You guys have got to go check it out. It is absolutely fabulous. It is so fitting. So, there's like lots of questions though, obviously right now, mm-hmm. concerning Halloween and the pandemic. And obviously right. it's kind of put a lot of damper on a lot of people's like
yeah,
celebrations.
Absolutely.
And, like it's a lot of, but we're not really here to debate about what to do about it. Mm-hmm. But it did get me thinking, though, about Halloween candy when I was a kid.
Oh, yes.
And I'm such a weirdo. I don't know if you guys are like this, too. And we can be weirdos together. Yes. Let's just embrace our weirdism.
That's why we're friends, Tess.
Exactly. but I would go and I would try to collect as much candy as possible. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really a sugar person. Okay. I really don't. I mean, like, I'll sit and, like, chow down on candy sometimes, but I'm not, like, a sit there and, like, finish the bag of candy.
Right.
So sometimes my bag of Halloween candy would sit there in my bedroom untouched for, like, a year.
Right, right.
And, like, even my dad would, like, come in and try to sneak some, and I'd be like, no, mine, hoarding. But eventually I would, you know, like, let go and be like, yeah, sure, whatever. But,
so you'd
you know,
be like a candy dragon hoarding
I
your little.
I would hoard it like Smaug for a year until, you know, it was time to, you know, go get a new haul. And, but since we're, like, all kind of thinking about it, I don't know if you remember when, like, you're a kid, your parents are, like, you have to check the wrapper. You have to check every single wrapper for needle, like, pokes or, like,
yeah.
little slits in the side. There could be a razor in it. There could be poison. Like, every year, like, our parents would sit there and go through our candy with it. And I always thought it was a ploy that was just, like, the parents needed to, like, taste test certain things. That they was their
oh, yeah, the parent
to, like,
tax.
Steal candy. You know, there's the parent tax and stuff. But
the mom and dad tax. Sorry. We have
but,
it.
So while we're thinking, though, about the invisible but very real baddie that is our you know, current pandemic, there's another old myth, though, that comes to mind that
it comes to mind every year.
Every year. Do people really put razors in candy to hurt kids? Mm-hmm. And is there any truth to this? Or is it just a secret code for parents to steal their kids' stash? That's what we're covering today.
Awesome.
So we've got kind of a fun topic.
Okay.
I mean, there's some kids have been injured, so I wouldn't say it's like, you know,
super
yay.
Fun, but it's like, yeah.
but I found out some kind of interesting things, including this first fact I'm going to share with you guys.
Okay.
So the basic story goes that you have to pay extra attention to your candy haul when you get back from Halloween and the night of debauchery to check for those holes and cuts. But they allege that these vindictive kid hating strangers go around living their lives in our neighborhood every day, except for, you know, one night a year, they want to kill your kids with their candy. and that they would hide poisons or sharp objects like razor blades, needles, or broken glass in your Snickers bar and then distribute them to kids.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you recall or haven't watched this season already, there's an independent film called Trick or Treat. If anybody remembers that movie, it's a series kind of a, like short stories that kind of blend into one kind of timeline.
Okay.
Definitely worth a watch, but there is a scene in it that is horrifying that deals with this topic. A character poisons another character with Halloween candy. It is very graphic.
Oh, God. Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Stomach churning scene. In fact, it's one of those things that made me turn it off the first time I saw it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go back and watch it one more time.
Oh, was that
right
bad?
After that scene. I mean, it's bad. Ooh. I it makes my bubble guts just thinking about it. but the fact is, there are actually no cases of this happening in real life, like proven of specifically, I'm going to get legal speak with you guys, okay. Specifically strangers poisoning children. I'll get into how okay. It's actually been used to for a couple of different reasons. But the story usually gets a lot of fervor if the child dies around Halloween.
Right.
So apparently a spoonful of sugar didn't always make the medicine go down. The claims that the candy was tampered with started to pop up during the Industrial Revolution, when mom wasn't making candy at home so much anymore because she was working or getting close to it, because the Industrial Revolution is a little early for women, but you know, more candy was being made in factories. Right, so there was more of a chance that, you know, something could end up in your candy bar, or somebody could personally poison you or try and, you know, and so there was this push to like make your candy.
I did not know that this sort of rumor has been around that long.
That long. I know.
I mean, the Industrial Revolution was the 1800s, right?
Yeah, exactly. And
that's 200 years that this sort of rumor has been circulating.
Has been perpetuated through, you know, as either a warning for kids or a manipulation to get, you know, women to back in the kitchen or et cetera. Mm-hmm. In fact, even some doctors at the time publicly claimed that they were treating poisoned kids every day. And when a child fell ill, the first blame at the time was usually candy.
Wow.
Like, it's like you've eaten too much candy and been sick.
Yeah.
But they would say like the candy's been poisoned, and it's like, no, the kid
OD'd on candy.
It, you know, exactly. But you know, violence and sugar apparently always, yet still never the answers.
Yeah. Well.
Now, the candy part, though, is partially true, although not necessarily the poisoning in the way that we're discussing. Mm-hmm. Remember Augustus Gloop?
Yes.
In either of the Wonka movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. It makes you sick just watching him eat that much candy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I go when I think of
Wonka. Wonka kind of poisoned
yourself.
His candy, so to speak.
That too. Exactly. He did technically poison him. So.
I mean, he poisoned Violet Beauregard, too, with that gum.
That's true. He was just poisoning kids left and right. Snozberries? I mean, what are they?
Snozberries, yeah.
So, but in the 1890s and 1900s, tons of candy was tested. They tested candy constantly because obviously the companies are like, I promise you our candy's not poisoned. And right. If strangers are doing it, then, like, you know, we want to know about that.
Right, right.
You know. You know, cutting corners kills customers, mm-hmm. but they don't seem to get that now. But they did test them for, you know, poisons or waste contaminants. Mm-hmm. They were saying if there's anything we can do to help, but none was ever found. Candy's fine.
Yeah.
Candy's good.
Yeah.
Love
well, not
candy.
To mention the FDA was put into place to stop things like that from happening
exactly.
as well.
Exactly. And of course, the freaking race card and scary single women apparently are also a problem.
Right.
Apparently, we always have to take things here. Of course, the myth really blew up in the 1960s and the 1970s as a way to reinforce segregation or mm-hmm. spread distrust in segregated neighborhoods.
Right.
So they're saying, oh, yeah, no, don't go to his house. He's giving out poison candy. Like, come on. Come on.
Right, right. Of course.
So also, I thought this was interesting. With the uprising of women breaking away from traditional roles, stories about a judgmental neighbor, abusive parent, or careless adults gripped public attention harder, basically making gossip and rumor panic spread like wildfire. So mm-hmm. they're like, oh, she's a working girl. Like, you know,
right. Well,
she,
I mean,
you know,
you have to remember, even, you know, just as far back as like the women's rights movements and mm-hmm. the civil rights movements, it's like, suffragettes were painted as mm-hmm. monsters, you
exactly.
know, and goblins and, you know, man,
how dare you want
man
rights.
Killers oh. and haters of children. So it doesn't surprise me that they used, you know, single working women as a way to perpetuate, you know, the evil witch. Well, I mean, you could probably even look even as far back as Hansel and Gretel, you know, it was a single woman. She was obviously a witch and she poisons children with her candy.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know.
Or, you know, she works, she must not love her kids. Therefore,
yeah.
you know, and then these rumors, you know, as we see, like, as you know, like it's a movie like Edward Scissorhands, the cookie cutter, you know, postage stamp little
oh,
neighborhood
right. yeah.
and stuff. And
yeah,
they gossip
little, you know.
And that's, you know, what's important. And they you know, going to the hair salon to talk, you know, with each other. That's a trope for a reason, you know?
Yeah. It happened a lot.
So that's how those kinds of rumors would just, you know, spread.
And now we have Facebook to spread them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now we just, we literally tweet. We just chirp at each other.
Yeah.
So now we get kind of to like a slightly darker,
oh,
little
okay.
bit
Okay, I'll take a deep breath and stop giggling.
Myths don't necessarily come from thin air, and there have been a few instances of questionable behavior that fit in with the conspiracy.
Okay.
In 1959, a dentist named William Shine gave candy-coated laxatives to trick-or-treaters.
I heard this about that.
And that's actually kind of reminiscent of that scene I mentioned earlier about called Trick-or-Treat.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the same basic concept of an extreme laxative given to a child.
Oh,
he was charged. This actual man, though, was charged with public or with outrage of public decency and unlawful dispensing of drugs.
Right.
Now, depending on how much laxative you take, that isn't necessarily going to kill you. It might feel like it's going to kill you. Like, oh, my God.
But it's
technically not poisoning. I mean, you are administering a drug to somebody who's unaware that they are being given that.
Right.
So,
and especially if it's children, it's like,
yeah,
a small dose goes a long way with children.
Exactly. But I see this more as a fed up dentist, because remember, it was like 1959, who knew that candy was probably rotting teeth,
right,
and he tried to get back at them for like not flossing and, you know, not brushing their teeth.
Right.
But,
right,
you know, these days.
Oh, these days he'd be sued by every family member.
Dentists do have much more pleasant alternatives for your candy haul if you're like me and you just kind of hold on to it for a year. Mm-hmm. They do collect bags of candy in exchange for like little goodies or money, and they send them to rot the teeth of the poor military members overseas.
Yeah, I have seen there are some dentists' offices that, you know, they'll take your bags of candy and exchange them for money or, mm-hmm, you know, little toys and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I have
to definitely don't poison kids now.
Yeah, to encourage, you know, like healthier teeth and stuff like that. And, yeah, they send it to, you know, me and my brothers and sisters and family members in arms to rot our teeth because we're adults.
You guys too. Exactly. So I hope you guys enjoy our ill-gotten candy. We're trick-or-treating for you.
Thank you.
Your army of trick-or-treaters. Oh, man. So I digress. In 1964, in Long Island, a woman was caught giving out packages of inedible items to kids that she believed were too old to be trick-or-treating. And for the record, you are never too old.
No, you are not.
If you come to my door in a costume, ring the bell, and say trick-or-treat, I'm giving your ass a Snickers.
If you're an adult, I will do that. I've seen a lot of people, especially our age, moving towards that, where it's like, you know, if you want to go out and participate in a fun, lighthearted, carefree childlike activity, there's no age limit for that.
Candy,
you know, if you come trick-or-treat my door in a costume, you better believe I'm gonna give you candy, and I'm gonna give you a high five too.
If you don't eat this candy, eventually I'm gonna be like COVID stressed out and eat all the candy.
Oh, I know, I'll end up eating it myself. Help me out. Help me get rid of this candy.
I usually at least buy one bag of candy at like the very beginning of the season, and I have it's usually gone in a couple of days. I'm going to wait on this. Maybe I'll wait till right after Halloween and all the leftovers. But what did she put in people's bags? Remember the things putting inedible things in people's trick-or-treat bags. Some reported steel wool.
Oh.
Dog biscuits.
Okay,
and
those aren't
buttons.
Unedible.
Yeah. And ant buttons, which are actually poison, but thankfully, these teenagers weren't stupid, and no one was injured. So,
what are ant buttons?
Like ant poison?
Oh, little pellets of ant poison. Oh,
yeah. Which they're even marked poison on them. I was like, here,
steel wool. That's gross. Like dog biscuits. That's not really inedible. You can
maybe
eat dog
on a
biscuits.
Dare. Like,
yeah,
you know, because I mean, really, what are you gonna feed your dog that you can't eat?
Yeah, they're made of edible products. They may not taste great, but they're at least they're technically edible.
Technically.
A lot of things are technically edible.
Technically edible. There you go. Oh, man. So that same year, though, there were reports of lye-filled bubble gum, also technically edible, but not, in Detroit, and rat poison in Philadelphia, but neither of those were found to be true.
Okay.
They were just kind of, you know, those little
urban legends that
urban
go around
legends.
To scare people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There are a couple of misattributed events. Like I said, that this conspiracy tends to pop up, you know, if a child dies around Halloween.
Right, Right.
In 1970, 5-year-old Kevin Tostin of Detroit found and ate his uncle's heroin stash and died after a 4-day coma. Ooh. The family initially actually tried to protect his uncle, saying that the drug had been sprinkled in the child's Halloween candy.
Oh, God.
And then obviously the investigation came down to, right. I don't think that's true. 8 years later.
That's rough.
2-year-old Patrick Weinerhold, in Flint, Michigan, died after eating Halloween candy. Toxicology reports in that case found no evidence of poison, and his death was attributed to natural causes. So they don't really know what caused his death, but he died right around Halloween.
Gotcha.
Then in 1990, more than 20 years later, 30 years ago, a 7-year-old in Santa Monica, California, named Ariel Katz, died while trick-or-treating. Mm-hmm. Poor thing. Initial reports blamed poisoned candy again. Mm-hmm. But despite this poor girl's parents pleading with people to understand, this poor girl was already diagnosed with an enlarged heart.
Oh,
and that's what killed her, unfortunately, on Halloween while she was trick-or-treating. So her parents are telling people, like,
ran wild,
I'm telling you, this is how she died. And like, that was poisoned candy. Like, no, we already knew this was the case. We knew this could happen.
Yeah.
Sadly, it did. And so that was her actual cause of death. In 2001, a 4-year-old girl in Vancouver, British Columbia, died after eating Halloween candy. Again, people tried to hop on that poison candy bandwagon, but she actually died of a streptococcus infection.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's a wicked way to die.
Yeah, no kidding.
Poor kid. There is also technically one instance of distributed poisoned candy, but technically no one targeted was affected.
Okay.
Back in 1978, so going back again, an 8-year-old boy from Deer Park, Texas, died after eating a pixie stick laced with cyanide. A police investigation found that the candy had been tampered with and planted by his father, Ronald Clark O'Brien, who gave out the poison candy to other children in the neighborhood in an attempt to cover up the murder.
Ooh.
So he like handed it out to a bunch of kids, including his own kid. Thankfully, none of the other kids ate that candy, but like honestly, miraculously though, because who doesn't like a little snorting sugar? I mean, in the form of pixie sticks, pixie sticks.
I remember kids on the bus back in high school and middle school.
And I did not do that
snort.
For the record. I watched
I never
other people.
Did either, but I definitely knew a lot of kids that snorted pixie sticks.
Oh,
so.
God, yeah. And the what a mess.
They're probably doing cocaine now.
They're not doing well. but the murderer, though, in that case, was eventually executed in 1984.
Oh, okay.
In that case. So, and thankfully, no other kids were involved in that. But that is a case of a kid dying by poisoned Halloween candy.
Right, right.
Not by a stranger.
It was done by a family member.
Exactly.
Gotcha. That's why you use that legal terminology earlier.
Exactly. And how is the media, though, involved? People love to blame the media for drumming up hysteria because it did. And it did kind of happen here, too. Despite claims of poison candy being proved false, the news media promoted the story continuously through the 80s with local news stations featuring frequent coverage. That's why it covered it, like carried on into our childhoods. Like that. You know,
I remember. Yeah. On the news.
Check your candy. Always check your candy.
Every year they would tell us to check our candy. Like
that's why we have things like trunk or treat now because we're not sure who has candy.
Yep.
But I wanted to take a second though here to explain kind of how hysteria affects like the way news coverage.
Oh yes, that'd actually be really good because you work in the news. So
yeah, and so when something like this happens, because like people tend to be like, oh, the media is just blowing this up and like you guys only talk about this. Well, you know, like it's called a developing story for a reason. We're trying to update you on what's going on. In this case, we may have had a lot of viewers that were saying like, you need to talk about, which you guys still do. And so we talked about it.
Yeah.
And so when sometimes, you know, if we talked about every time somebody wags their finger and says, you guys never talk about, we would never stop talking, which I know I've said on this show before.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to kind of explain that like sometimes like we are listening to the viewers and that is why things do get kind of drummed, you know, excited. Also, understand that the people that are in the newsroom are your neighbors.
Yeah.
Like, we're journalists, but we're also concerned about some of the same things. We have our own kids. We have our own families. We're, you know, so, you know, same thing. They're just like the people, you know, that you pass every day on the street. Yeah. So we're, you know, we're only human. And sometimes there's, you know, too many humans headed in one direction.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of touch on that.
I appreciate that.
Don't always blame the news media, because guys, like, your local news is really trying to help. We are your local, we are your neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And, you know, it's easy to blame the media for everything, you know, but when you're the first one to break a story, nobody has all the facts yet, you know? So it's like, you can't blame them for, it's not that they're intentionally reporting misinformation. They may not have all the facts yet. In fact, they probably don't, but they're reporting what they do have.
Which, you know, sometimes we do jump the gun, and that's how we end up with, like, we can't trust the news media because they just, you know, produce it without, you know, they pump it out there without saying anything, you know, without really backing it up or making sure that that's right. And that can be a problem. That can and
does happen. Yeah.
But sometimes we are going off of, like, the officer's investigation has gone this far. Mm-hmm. We tell you the officer's investigation went this far.
Yeah.
Then there's an update, happened to be wrong. The officers were wrong. So we have to go back and correct it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or we maybe got information wrong. That does happen too. But, but sometimes when we have to update, it's not always that, like, our fault. Don't shoot the messenger is my point. Do not shoot the messenger.
Yes.
Oh man, I don't want to fall apart at the end of this. This is a good one. It's a good one.
Okay.
But anyway, so in conclusion, a sociologist at the University of Delaware has devoted his time to candy tampering legends, actually.
Oh, okay.
In newspaper reports from 1958 to 1983, he found fewer than 90 instances that might have actually qualified as candy tampering. But he says none of those events could be considered random attempts to harm children. Usually they involved an adult trying to earn some fast cash or kids trying to get attention. So that was another thing that did pop up quite a bit, were kids either trying to get attention or trying to get out of something.
Right.
Saying, like, they would plant it in there and be like, "Mom, look what I found." And because they heard about the story or an adult, you know, had mentioned something.
And, a lot of kids and teenagers, they try to perpetuate the scary story, you know. I mean, it's like, that's just kids being stupid, but...
Yeah. 5 child deaths were initially considered to be caused by homicidal strangers, but none of those were substantiated by an investigation. So they were like, either they decided not to investigate or they found out that through investigation, they're like, I don't think there's really a case here. I think this was just either natural causes or, you know...
Or it didn't happen.
What have you. Yeah. Or it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But since then, most tampering cases which show up still do show up about once or twice a year, usually involve someone trying to play a prank on a friend or a family member, typically with sharp objects rather than poisoning. Although, either way, if that's how you prank your friends, grow up.
Yeah, that's not cute. Yeah, that's exactly. Not a cute look.
But as far as our written history in America that we know of, that's been reported, no child has ever been killed really by happened. A stranger with poison candy.
Gotcha.
But I also, there's a little asterisk I would like to add, a little caveat at the end here. And I would also like to debunk this myth that I have seen online lately. And please do not assume anything about me. I'm only going to say this once.
Mm-hmm.
Potheads will never give out their edibles to your children.
I knew you were going to go there.
That shit is very expensive.
Yeah.
And they are not wasting it on your crotch goblin.
Yeah, no, you see that post every year that, you know, they're putting their drugs in your candy. And, you know, they have these pictures of, you know, the CBD knockoffs, you know.
They could
like,
be mistaken. They could, yes, they are right. They could be mistaken for other candy.
Yes.
But anybody who bought those is not leaving them anywhere near children.
Those, you know, CBD candies and things like that, they cost a lot of money. And people aren't going to go out and buy, you know, a $20, $30 package of, you know, edibles candy to hand out to children. They're just not.
Exactly.
So
no,
it just, that's just baseless. And it's like, yes, the labels are made to imitate real candy labels, but the adults purchasing those know what they're buying and they're not going to just hand them out to children.
No.
So
no.
Yeah, they I knew you were going to go there and I'm glad you did, because if you didn't, I would have gone there.
But yeah, so I just wanted to, that is my story. That is my wrap up. So your kids are safe, but still check your candy. Go ahead and take the parent tax. You always want to check your candy,
you know, just check for, you know, just stuff that might be expired. You know, that's probably the only thing that could happen. Or check to make sure that there isn't candy in there that your kids may have allergies to.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
exactly.
And then this year, if you do go trick-or-treating, because some states are opened up to trick-or-treating and things, just sanitize the candy, you know, at the end of the night. You know, most candy comes pre-wrapped. It's easy to sanitize it. And then the candy inside is clean for the kids to eat. So, you know, just wipe down the wrappers, make sure that, you know, everything's cleaned up and your kids are
better
fine.
Safe.
Nobody, you
know, just give a little wipe down.
There are very, very few people in this world who intentionally want to hurt your children.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? We want functioning, happy, you know, adults.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yeah. You know, and just, you know, whoever is trick or treating your house, be kind. You know, they, if they're playing by the rules of trick or treating, give them some candy, you know, even if it's somebody my age, 33 years old, if I'm there in a costume trick-or-treating, give them some candy. They're trying to have some fun. And in a time like this, in a year like this that we're having, everybody deserves to have a little lighthearted fun.
Yeah. So, but please socially distance, wear your masks, wear an awesome Halloween mask.
Yes.
We want to see them.
Be careful.
Send them to
you know,
us.
Follow
really
the
cool.
rules. Trick-or-treating is a very... It's a good activity to be performed during a social distance sort of
which
time.
Reminds me, speaking of which,
okay,
we have Conspiracies and Cryptids masks on our gift shop store.
Yeah.
Merch store. That one. So get, speaking of which, gift shops, get one for your friends, get one for yourself, treat yourself.
My parents, you know, my parents and my brother got one.
That's right. So, that's right. And they're styling. So go check those out, guys, and wear them for Halloween. There's a couple different options that are on there. And and also you reminded me when you mentioned sanitizing the candy. I wanted to touch on this too. Mm-hmm. They've had to reprint a number of ballots in California because people are sanitizing them.
Oh.
Or microwaving them.
Yeah.
Guys, I appreciate your gumption. I really do. But just fill it out, send it back.
Yeah, you don't need to
send it out
as your ballot. Just
send it back.
Fill it out, send it back. They're prepared to handle that. They will sanitize it properly. You don't need to.
Exactly. So. And if you're worried, wear gloves. But you're not going to get anything from your ballot except a say in what's going on.
By the time it's gotten to your mailbox, there's probably no germs on it anyway.
Exactly.
But so, we should take this time to say vote.
Please vote.
Please
vote.
You know, I mean, obviously, if you're not in America, you know, it's vote in your country.
Exactly.
But
vote in your country. But
our election
is
coming up, and we definitely highly encourage everybody to please vote.
Please vote, and vote educated. Do your Googlings, make sure you know what and don't forget to vote in your local elections. Those are very, very important.
Just as important.
Start small. Yeah. So,
changes start at local level. All changes start at local level. So it's like, you know, yes, the presidential election is important, but your local elections are just as important because they affect you more personally.
Absolutely.
So soapboxes we stand on.
Yes. Well, we are so happy to see our fellow Americans doing their civic duty, even though it's been made very difficult this year, and every year before, but we could do this.
We can make it.
So, all right, guys, I think that's, we have any other notes?
No, just
we wrap it up.
Thank you, everybody. As always, we love and appreciate all of you so much. And, you know,
please send us your ghost stories.
Yes,
please
send us your ghost stories
at gmail.com.
Yep.
Or any of our social media.
Yep. So, I mean, you know, we have this every outro, but I'm just going to repeat it anyway. Our email is conspiriesandcryptids@gmail.com. Our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram is all at CryptiPod. Our website is conspiriesandcryptids.com. You can send us a message from there as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of ways to get a hold of us. Please send us your ghost stories. We want to read them. We want to say your name on the air. This is your chance to have part of the spotlight, please send them.
Even if it's fake, write me something cool. Write me a short story. I love it. Please be creative. Just if you've got some time, let's be creative together, guys.
Let's have fun this Halloween.
Convince me of some bullshit. That's our new tagline.
Oh my God, that's great. Well, thank you guys for listening. We will be back on Halloween, and then immediately on November 1st, the very next day, we will be back with a special guest, Sam from What's in Your Hometown.
What's in Your Hometown?
Yes. Yay! So Julia was on a couple episodes ago, and well, both Sam and Julia have been on in the past. Julia was on a couple episodes ago. Sam has finished her move, and she is coming back on. So she will be on November 1st. So you've got Halloween, and then the very next day, November 1st. So two episodes, 2 days in a row to look forward to after this one. So
it's like Black Friday and Christmas and Thanksgiving. We're just going to fill your bellies with nonsense.
Ear candy.
Ear candy. All right, guys. I think that's it. So be safe. Wash your hands. Wear your mask. Social distance. You know, common sense. We can get through this together. And don't forget,
Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiriesandcryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cryptipod. That's CRYPTIPOD. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at Cryptipod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.